evangelist Billy Graham said this about the U.S. elections back in May of this year. Whoever gets that nomination, and it looks like it may be Mr. Trump, I don't know how things will fall out. I will vote for whoever gets that nomination, she said. And then when I vote for him, I'm going to pray for him every day. Daniel served under Nebuchadnezzar. He was like the Saddam Hussein of his day. And in the end, Nebuchadnezzar gave glory to the God of Daniel because of what he saw in Daniel's life. Don't worry. I don't want to talk about Donald Trump this morning. And in fairness, this analogy could logically be applied the other way towards the other candidate or towards any given political leader around the world. A particular politician may be less than impeccable, but they otherwise meet some minimum criteria, or more so than their rival anyway. So you hope that time and prayer will help improve their performance and eventually remove that bitterness in your mouth. Because as one of my in-laws says, the lesser of two evils is still evil. And now you know what one of my in-laws thinks of their choices. This Nebuchadnezzar metaphor shows up a lot in the media, and I had used it myself in response to Israeli and secular friends who had asked me how I could explain evangelicals' choice of candidate. But I couldn't help thinking that it wasn't a good analogy. Nebuchadnezzar was not an Israelite king, so the Israelites really had no part in his election. And any political influence they might hope to have would be at best peripheral in a system of government that was foreign and aloof. So what might be a good example from the Bible of an Israelite leader who, despite his overwhelming failings, still garnered the support of the people of Israel? There are, of course, so many who fit this bill to choose from, but I immediately thought of Samson. Now again, this is purely hypothetical and could be applied as an analogy to in today's world to any leader in any country, because I am not, as I said, talking about you-know-who. because Samson, contrary to the superhero persona that is so often portrayed in children's Bible storybooks and Bible classes, was a deeply flawed character. That is to say, he wasn't a larger-than-life incredible Hulk that later renditions make him out to be. Rather, he was most discernibly a hothead and a philanderer, someone you could immediately recognize and relate to. In hindsight, it's clear now why the rated R bits were sanitized out of the story for us as children, but even as adults, we somehow don't allow them to fully damage our assessment of Samson. We recognize that he made the wrong choice at a few junctures in his life, which led to some quite unfortunate consequences. But my goodness, how we are dazzled by that incredible strength, that miraculous strength. If God is seemingly with him, who are we to question his exploits? Certainly there's the unavoidably complicated and messy situation with the Philistine women. I mean, Samson here is a poster child for what Paul in the New Testament would call unequally yoked. You know the verse, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness?" 2 Corinthians 6:14. And yet, aside from when the angel notifies Samson's barren mother that he would be born and that he is to be a Nazarite, his one decision to marry a Philistine woman is about the only other time in the story about which it is said he did what God wanted him to do. Apparently, God wanted him to be unequally yoked with the Philistine woman. Here's the passage in Judges. So the woman bore him a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Machane Dan between Soah and Eshtaol. Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife. Then his father and mother said to him, Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, Get her for me, for she pleases me well. But his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. That almost sounds like a green light for Samson and a justification for whatever might come next. We know the story, but I'll give a quick recap. Samson heads down to Timnah with his parents, and on the way he's attacked by a lion. The Spirit of God comes upon him mightily, and he tears up the lion like it's nothing, but his parents don't see it happen. They reach their destination and meet the woman he likes. It's all good. Sometime later, Samson returns to get her and finds the lion carcass on the way filled with bees and honey. They have a feast at the woman's house, and Samson poses a riddle about the lion and the honey to 30 guests who are present, who would have no way of solving the riddle. But Samson has bet them 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing, and when they inevitably fail to solve the riddle, they threaten his new wife. They say, Entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Understandably, she feels blackmailed and trapped, so she complies and begs and pries the answer out of Samson. When the guests come back with the correct answer, he realizes what their methods were. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. It's charming and it rhymes in Hebrew anyway. From this point on, I think one can objectively say that Samson quickly spirals downward and never really recovers. Frankly, he's an unmitigated disaster. The Bible goes on to say, Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. Did you catch that? I didn't when I first read it, and this certainly isn't one of his more celebrated accomplishments that we hear in Bible school class for kids. He went to a different Philistine town and killed and robbed 30 men who had absolutely nothing to do with this whole affair, apparently because he didn't want to have to pay for out of his own pocket for the wager that he lost. Okay, but how do we know what he did was wrong? It's not an entirely silly question. I mean, on the face of it, this should not look good for Samson. But still, it's never a good idea to jump to conclusions. Some have commented that all of the Philistines were oppressors and idolaters and therefore guilty and worthy of punishment or a divine retribution of some sort. Others suggest more complicated plots that help absolve Samson of what looks like wanton violence. Yet the moral and logical contortions one has to perform to explain away and find legitimacy in his actions start to become impossibly unwieldy. In any case, Samson half admits it. Sometime later, he decides to go back to his wife, whom he has abandoned, but discovers his father has given her in marriage to his best man. I thought you hated her. Have her younger sister instead, her father says. This sends him into a rage again, and he plots more violence by lighting some animals on fire and setting them loose in Philistine territory. But he says, This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. So he recognizes that he was not blameless the first time. Why he thinks he would be blameless after provoking them this time is another matter. The thing is, the story continues in this pattern to the bitter end. Samson, as we know, is captured after foolishly revealing the secret of his strength to Delilah, and he is brought bound in chains to the temple of Dagon in Gaza to entertain the lords of the Philistines and about 3,000 men and women. we know what he does next. Because his eyes have been plucked out, he asks the boy guiding him to lead him to the supporting pillars so he can ask God if he will grant him his miraculous power one last time. And because Samson's last feat of strength amounts to a mass casualty suicide attack, generations have struggled with its moral implications. I believe the story intends for us to struggle with Samson's moral decisions. It says the Philistines had gathered to give thanks to their God for delivering into their hands Samson, their enemy, the destroyer of their land, and the one who multiplied their dead. In other words, they were actually aware of the significance of Samson's capture on a national and spiritual level. So surely as Samson stood by those pillars, aware of the national leaders and citizens in the temple, surely he too sought to rectify the injustices being committed towards his nation, or maybe avenge some offense towards the God of Israel. If the sins and crimes of the people were so great, one could conceive of a proportionate punishment. But this was Samson's prayer. O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. My two eyes. The story ends with his family coming to retrieve his body to bury it in his home near Tzora'ah. He had judged Israel for 20 years, it says. But the very beginning of the story opens with a typical introduction. And again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So for 20 of those 40 years, Samson was responsible for judging or leading Israel, but it evidently never succeeds in overthrowing Philistine dominance. And this is my point now that I'm halfway through my message. This story is meant to be read tragically, not in glorification of the violence and swaggering bravado. And by tragedy, I don't mean hopelessness. Those are not the same by any means. The entire narrative of the Bible could be summed up as a story of God faithfully reaching out in relationship to his people over and over again. The theme of God's faithfulness is unrelenting. Therefore, know the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. Deuteronomy 7:9. Your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Psalm 36:5. Through the Lord's mercies we are not consumed, but because his compassions fail not, they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Lamentations 3:22-23. And this is a great one from Romans. For what if some did not believe? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? Certainly not. Indeed, let God be true and every man a liar. Romans 3:3. The purpose of a grand narrative that constantly emphasizes this theme of God's ultimate faithfulness over generations is to act as a reminder and provide meaning when it is difficult to find God in the immediate context, when all seems hopeless. Imagine this is you during Samson's era. You're 20 years old, dreaming of embarking on a new career, but you realize all opportunities will be stymied by the Philistine regime since coming under their occupation. You've been crushed by having to watch your father fork over such a large portion of his earnings in taxes. So you're thrilled by the rumors of a new revolutionary who seems willing to wage some kind of campaign of resistance. And you've heard something about this revolutionary being a Nazarite. What were Nazarites? Nazarites were a peculiar group in the same way that the people of Israel were peculiar. If the Israelites served the role of proving to the world the story of God's faithfulness to his covenant people, then the Nazarites played a similar role among the people of Israel. The Israelites kept all kinds of laws and regulations, usually for moral purposes, but very often purely for ceremonial reasons. As if to say, these particular rules are meant just for you to stand out, to signify that you have been set apart, chosen for a special purpose. Likewise, when a Nazirite went to a wedding or walked into a pub, it immediately stood out that his hair was long and that he constantly had to remind people that he didn't drink alcohol. There was no inherent morality in either short or long hair. It was the difference that was meant to stand out in such a way as to remind people that a vow had been taken, a vow to God. And this is why, with Samson, despite his personal tragedy and the larger national failure, you can still see God's ultimate faithfulness to his promises. Here is Samson doing everything he can to forfeit his gift, and yet God, in his unending mercy, gives him chance upon chance to return to his original purposes for his life. He had promised through the angel that Samson would be a Nazirite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines, end quote. And when he was born, it says, the child grew and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him. These were promises that God was going to honor despite Samson's failings, despite what almost seemed like a mission of self-sabotage. But I think the Bible is also very clear about God. And here I want to say something controversial, even though it shouldn't be. And that is that God is not bound by our expectations of him. The clearest example of this is Samson's and his family's Nazirite vow. They were obligated not to drink wine or to let a razor come upon his head, but that did not by any means obligate God to turn Samson into Superman. It was not a formula or a magic potion. To believe otherwise is to make Samson into a magician and God a very small god indeed. Maybe that was partially the reason God destroyed the temple of Dagon, to prove they were dealing with God, not a failed magician. This seems obvious enough in this context, but the Israelites had to learn this lesson over and over again. Whether they put some magic hope in the Ark of the Covenant going into battle with them, the magic belief that the physical presence of the temple would obstruct an invading army, or that merely invoking the right prayer, maybe by the right man of God, reminding God that they were the chosen people on the promised land, maybe that would be enough. As a formula, it didn't work. The faithful God would keep his covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations, but he won't necessarily catch us if we choose to jump off a cliff or self-destruct in 1,000 other ways. Formulas can be cheated and manipulated, but not God. So a final note on Samson is that our lives aren't ultimately measured by our exploits. I think this story makes clear that something much more significant and essential than even his miracles was critically in need of attention in his life. That is something I find difficult to remember in my own life. This, of course, causes me to stress about where my life is leading on a grand scale, to the neglect of my behavior on a day-by-day and moment-by-moment basis. There are only so many times I can miss reading or playing football with my boys because I was busy with more important things, important thoughts, other worries, before those opportunities are lost forever. Just generally in life, consistently taking an opportunity to pay a compliment here or to say sorry there, an opportunity to grab a coffee just to check up on things with someone here, a phone call to settle the logistics on some outstanding matter there, look up something on Yad Shtayim, a short prayer of repentance, of forgiveness. These are all tiny disciplines that will far outweigh any book that may or may not ever be written outweigh any high position ever attained or empire built. Postscript on Uriah the Hittite, King David's valiant warrior and Bathsheba's husband. Imagine the absolute dedication and commitment to the smallest principles Uriah the Hittite must have had to be called back from the battlefield, granted a short reprieve, and yet he refused to go home to his wife. None of his comrades in arms would have known or begrudged him, were they to find out, if he had chosen to, as he said, go to his house to eat and drink and lie with his wife. But this is what God, through the prophet Nathan, says about the most famous and loved king in history when he has Uriah murdered. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. King David repents, but not before Nathan tells him a parable about a rich shepherd stealing a poor shepherd's lamb. David may not have recognized immediately who he was meant to identify with in the thinly veiled parable, but I think it's clear who we are supposed to admire. David's achievements and his pedigree should not impress us. Even the injustice of Uriah's fate should not deter us from acknowledging who we should want to emulate. God may not be terribly impressed by grand exploits, but I think if we were to compare the tragic lives of Samson and Uriah, my wager is that God might be more impressed by the faithful life that led Uriah to die leading his men into battle on the outskirts of Rabbath Ammon than the wanton life that led Samson to die alone in the rubble of a temple in Gaza. So I hope that wasn't too harsh.